Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And in this episode, we're going to be discussing Lee Wannell's adaptation of the classic Universal monster movie, The Invisible Man. This one features Elizabeth Moss in the lead role, but not the title role. It's a little bit different from the... it's a lot different from the original. But one of the main ways in which it's different is that the title character is not the protagonist. It's not the main character. In this one, Elizabeth Moss plays a woman who was married to this pathological narcissist, sociopath, who is, you know, very controlling. And she gets free of him and he fakes his own death and begins to torment her using this technology. He's this optics expert or something.
Yeah, the title sort of gives the game away, and they know that this is a rehash of a rehash of a rehash by this point, so they really don't bury the lead right from the opening scene. Even before Adrian is dead or supposedly dead, you still have the camera lingering on empty spaces as if to suggest maybe there's something there that you can't see. The whole movie is designed that way. They know that if you buy a ticket to a movie called The Invisible Man, if you've seen any version of this H.G. Wells story over the past 100 or more years, then you pretty much know the score.
But yeah, as I implied, this is not your grandfather's Invisible Man. You will not be seeing a pair of pants skipping down the street with Claude Rains' voice singing, "Here we go gathering nuts in May."
A damn shame, too, because... like, you could actually take some of the Invisible Man wrestling scenes from this movie and just overlay Claude Rains' maniacal gloating over it, and it would be like Claude Rains was starring in this movie. That's the beauty of it. Anyone can be the Invisible Man. Kay Bake could give it another shot if he was so inclined.
Indeed. The Hollow Man. Anyway, before I get any further into the weeds here, Matt, how about you just kick off the synopsis in earnest?
Well, Jim, we open with
You sound so resigned. Well, you know, Jim, I hate to say it, but we open with...
I've just said those words, "we open," so many goddamn times.
I mean, I say exactly the same thing every time I start the podcast, so...
Actually, this time you didn't say, "and we're the Shock Doctors."
Oh, fuck.
I would put money on it. Let's not start over. We're too deep into the thing now.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
We open with a shot of a bedroom, a bed in this big, open, very modernist-looking, all-glass, floor-to-ceiling windows straight out of Michael Mann's Heat kind of loft house situation where Elizabeth Moss is in bed with her abusive boyfriend, husband? I think
husband.
Boyfriend. Husband. Okay.
Husband.
And she extricates herself from his embrace very gingerly, spends several very tense minutes tiptoeing around the house, gathering her things, disabling security cameras. She's flying the coop. She's drugged him, and she doesn't want to wake him up because there'll be hell to pay.
Yeah. And in case it's not clear that this was all very well planned out in advance, when we say gathering her things, it's really more she grabs her go bag.
Right.
And she's ready to get the hell out, but she gets held up on the way out by the dog. It's not that the dog is barking or trying to stop her. It's that the dog clearly wants to go with her because presumably her husband's abusing her. He's abusing the dog too. You know, an abuser's an abuser, I guess. So first she's trying to tell the dog, no, I can't take you with me. And then she decides otherwise and goes and is fumbling with this very elaborate shock collar, trying to get it off. And while she's doing that...
Adrian has probably made her wear one of those at various points in their relationship. You get the sense that that's just how controlling he is.
Yeah. So while she's trying to get the collar off, the dog kind of fidgets and bumps into the car in the garage, and this sets off the alarm, and that's when she knows she has to book it, which she does.
It's funny because I at least spent this whole scene thinking, like, no, ditch the dog, just get the fuck out of there, when in fact, knowing what this movie is about, I should have been thinking, no, definitely keep the dog. A dog would be a huge asset in a movie like this. Anything with a sense of smell more developed than yours is a good ally to have in your corner. But I wasn't thinking that far ahead. I was very caught up in the moment, which is a sign that a movie is working. You know?
Right, exactly. if you're trying to tell the character to do things, you're probably not paying enough attention.
Yeah, and if you're specifically instructing the character to leave the dog to its fate and just save their own skin, then yeah, I mean, if you're actively encouraging the character to do the disreputable thing, then right, the movie's got its hooks in you.
Yeah. So Elizabeth Moss, Cecilia is her character's name. Cecilia is fleeing across this massive estate. It's got a big concrete wall all the way around the grounds, which she scales, throws her bag over, and flees into the woods. This is somewhere in the outskirts of San Francisco, somewhere in Marin County, I guess. And she flees through the woods and makes it to a sort of deserted, narrow road through the forest. And she's expecting someone to be there, someone named Emily. We later find out it's her sister. And Emily is not there. So she's frantically just kind of like hoping that her sister's going to show up and can't really do anything. So she's just kind of standing there waiting, and finally, she sees headlights and her sister pulls up. And this is a moment that's in every one of the trailers for this movie that I've seen. So this is not a surprise to anyone.
It got the better of some of the people in the audience that we were with tonight. I heard it get a rise out of at least one person.
Well, fuck them. Anyway. Yeah, so Cecilia gets in the car, and then as she's trying to get her sister to shift to drive
fucking
and get the
step
hell out,
on it, yeah.
Yeah, Adrian, the abusive husband, charges out of the dark like the fucking Terminator, the T-1000, and then starts pounding on the window, open the door, and then puts a fist through the window, and then finally Emily gets the hint. But crucially, Cecilia has dropped her pill bottle of diazepam on the ground outside the car, and we see Adrian pick that up. So that's planting and payoff. Obviously, the payoff comes later, but that's the planting.
We pick up with Cecilia 2 weeks later. She is shacked up with Emily's ex. Is that right? Or are they still... I wasn't sure what the relationship was there. Are they just friends?
I
feel a little silly asking, because...
I honestly don't know what their relationship is.
So it's very amicable, whatever it is.
Right.
So if they are split up, the movie does not use the conventional shorthand to tell you, like, oh, these people are divorced or separated or taking a break or whatever.
So Cecilia is staying with James and his daughter, Sydney, and it's not clear whether James is just a friend or possibly it's Emily's ex, and that's how they know each other. It's not very clear, but again, as Matt says, there doesn't seem to be any tension there. Everybody's friends.
Yeah.
And Cecilia is suffering from pretty severe agoraphobia. She doesn't want to go outside because she doesn't trust the outside because Adrian could be out there.
She's taking tentative steps towards the mailbox, which has sort of become a weekly ritual of hers when she's spooked by a jogger who reminds her of Adrian tearing ass towards the car in a hoodie. Yeah. And so then she returns to the safety of the house. She also, we see her like spray painting over her webcam. She is convinced that Adrian is going to continue antagonizing her, continue spying on her. Not unreasonably, we come to find.
Yeah.
This whole stretch of the movie reminded me of... It made me feel like I was watching a version of Copycat that was less of a guilty pleasure. Like a more respectable Copycat.
Right.
The Sigourney Weaver one. Emily comes to the house. Cecilia says, "What are you doing here? He knows where you live. He could have followed you here. I told you to let me do this my way." Emily says, "You don't have to worry." Hands over her phone. There's a news item about Adrian having taken his own life.
Yeah, because in addition to being just an abusive fuck who happens to have a lot of money, hence the mansion, he's also apparently a tech leader. As I was saying in the intro, he's a leader in the field of optics, apparently.
Yes, crucially.
Yeah, and that's how he makes himself invisible. And we can give you more details as they come up. But yeah, so he has apparently killed himself.
Cecilia celebrates by making it all the way to the mailbox, whereupon she finds a letter addressed to her. Weird, because no one is supposed to know that she's staying at this house. She was trying to lay low, and she is summoned to a reading of Adrian's will.
by his brother, who is apparently a lawyer and is the executor of his apparently deceased brother's estate. First, he tries to read this very grody, self-serving message from Adrian to Cecilia, and Emily cuts that shit off right quick.
Right. Yeah, thankfully, Cecilia has her sister there to advocate on her behalf because she's still pretty rattled.
Yeah. And so, after a little bit of back and forth, Tom, Adrian's brother, gets to the quote-unquote good part by revealing that Adrian has left Cecilia $5 million that's supposed to be paid out in a series of monthly increments over the course of 50 months, 100,000 at a time. Contingent upon the fine print is the is the line he uses. You can't be charged with a crime, etc., etc. He doesn't mention anything about mental competence that you see in the trailer until much later when it's more topical.
Far too late, yeah. Cecilia bestows a few gifts upon her hosts. She buys the dad a ladder, which is a pretty shabby gift for someone who just became a millionaire. But in point of fact, the ladder is just leading to an envelope on top of a bookshelf in which is enclosed.
It's a bank statement.
Yes, right.
Because Sydney is trying to go to school, apparently fashion school. I wasn't familiar with the name of the institution because I've never wanted to go to a fashion institute, I guess. But she wants to go to this school and it's very expensive. And
I said in the episode on The Turning that we never talk about the costumes on this fucking show. I guess I never wanted to go either.
Right. So apparently this place is very expensive and it didn't seem like it was going to be possible for Sydney to go. But Cecilia says, I'm going to deposit $10,000 a month for the next 12 months into this account. And I called the account Parsons. That's the name of the place. And so that's going to be able to pay for Sydney to go. I agree the ladder is a shabby gift, although it is topical because he's doing a bunch of home improvements and painting the house.
Yeah, they allude to the fact that he can use the ladder to keep painting, and that is yet more planting and payoff. This movie is full of Chekhov's items.
So
we're nowhere near done with that yet.
But even just beyond that, it's not as though the ladder is completely apropos of nothing and just useful to climb up to get to an envelope. even if it does pale in comparison to getting $120,000.
Right.
So, anyway.
Next scene, we get another Chekhov's blank in the form of, putting the cart before the horse a little bit. So, Cecilia is making breakfast. She's got eggs and bacon frying on a skillet. She steps out of the room for a moment, and in her absence, the heat gets cranked way up, starting a small fire on the stovetop. She runs back in. Sydney fetches a fire extinguisher. They extinguish the flames. And right away, I'm like, that's going to come back. At some point, the Invisible Man is going to get doused in flame retardant foam. There's just absolutely no way that's not going to happen.
Right.
So,
especially because they make a point of Cecilia's about to try and douse it with water, and Sydney's like, no, don't use water. I don't know exactly what the chemistry is on it, but presumably water is not good for dousing a grease fire. I think I did know that.
That
is a thing.
Cooking 101.
So, yes, fire extinguisher.
We get a series of Invisible Man antics, I guess, like low-key mischief over the course of the next 10, 15 minutes. Cecilia is standing on the porch on a cold night. She can see her own breath in the air, and you see puffs of breath, exhalations coming from behind her with no discernible source.
Probably my favorite part of the trailer.
Mm-hmm. At night, and this is to a degree Lee Wannell getting sort of back into on his James Wan bullshit, the blanket gets pulled off of her while she's sleeping, while she's in bed, and she gets up and tries to retrieve it, and there's something tugging on the other end of it. She becomes convinced that Adrian is still out to get her in some capacity. She hasn't connected all the dots. People are starting to fear for her sanity a little bit. She keeps cracking up more and more as the movie goes on, as Adrian applies more and more pressure.
Well, yeah, it really starts with the sheet shenanigans, because eventually she cries out and James rushes into the room and she starts talking about how he was right there. There was a footprint. And yeah, that's when she starts getting the side eye from people.
More Chekhovian fuckery in this scene. Sydney goes for a thing of pepper spray.
Right.
When Cecilia starts screaming, and you best believe that pepper spray is also coming back.
Yep.
Cecilia goes to a job interview the following morning and goes to retrieve some paperwork examples of her architectural drawings from a briefcase and finds the briefcase empty. She says, "I know that they were in here. I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on." She stands up and faints.
She gets taken to the hospital for some tests, and after she goes home, the doctor calls with the results and says she was just loaded up with diazepam. And as she's hearing this on the phone, she like walks into the bathroom and sees the pill bottle that she left behind that's got bloody fingerprints on it because Adrian picked it up after he punched through a glass window.
Mm-hmm. The doctor starts saying something about how the tests revealed something else that's too sensitive to relay over the phone, but you can barely hear it because Cecilia has let the phone fall to her waistline. She's in a daze, staring at the pill bottle. Cecilia and James, is that his name?
Yeah.
Go to Tom, the lawyer brother, master of the estate, and she confronts him, says, "Adrian's not dead. You know what he was like. You know what he's capable of. You have to believe me. Just tell him to call it off. Make him stop." Tom says, "Look," it's an interesting reverse heel turn. Do they call it a face turn in wrestling? I don't follow wrestling. I know less about wrestling than I do about haute couture.
Yeah.
But he says, "Listen," because in their first encounter, he seemed very hostile to her.
Yeah.
And now he relents a little and says, "My brother was controlling me for a long time before he ever met you. I know exactly what kind of man he was. He is dead. I found his body." He shows her pictures of his corpse, slit his wrists, seemingly. And that seems to appease her momentarily. But then in the very next scene, she goes to her sister's place, and her sister hits the roof because she got a really nasty email from Cecilia. Cecilia insists, "I didn't send that email. It's Adrian. He's out to get me." So right away, she thinks that he's alive again. I wasn't quite sure what to make. Because it seems like she's coming around to the idea that he really is dead. And then 90 seconds later, this email thing just kind of gets her right back where she was prior to the most recent interview with Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that she...
I understand that for an abused person, it doesn't take much to get them on edge again, in that trapped kind of temperament.
There's that, and also at the end of the day, like, what else is the explanation?
Right.
"I know I didn't send the email. Who else would have sent the email if not me or Adrian?"
Right. And you know how, what kind of disdain I have for movie characters who are really slow on the uptake. So, you know, it's not like I'm asking for a "no, it couldn't be," you know, like I'm Elizabeth
that
Moss.
Heinous.
Yeah, no, I mean, she's got it all figured out. This is the kind of movie where the woman protagonist has it all figured out and no one believes her. It's a classic gaslighting narrative, basically as classic as it gets. Why won't they believe me? Which entails a different kind of frustration from the protagonist being slow on the uptake frustration.
Watching a lot of gaslighting movies lately, I guess.
Yeah, it's a Me Too thing, I guess. It's just in the atmosphere these days. So Adrian is systematically isolating her the way he used to do when they were married. He next drives a wedge between her and James and Sydney. Cecilia and Sydney are sort of having a heart-to-heart, and then Sydney takes a smack across the face from an invisible presence, misconstrues it as having come from Cecilia. James runs into the room, says, "My daughter comes first," in effect, and the two of them get out of there, leaving Cecilia alone in the house. Or is she?
Well, yeah. This was one moment of what I thought was just a little bit of sloppiness on Lee Wannell's part, just because there's nothing wrong with that trick in principle of, you know, having the invisible man hit Sydney and make Sydney think it's Cecilia. But at the time it happens, Cecilia is like 8 or 10 feet away. And it just, I don't know, it seemed like...
I would say more like 4 or 5, but I take your point. I'm not going to get out the measuring stick.
It was too far.
Uh-huh.
And there was no reason why they couldn't just have done the blocking a little bit differently and had her close enough that it wouldn't have required such mental gymnastics for Sydney to be like, "You hit me from way over there." But then again, I mean, what else is Sydney going
to
think?
Well, so. Right. I think it's just meant to happen. And this comes up again later when the invisible man strikes in this movie. It happens with such suddenness that the recipient, if they have time to think anything at all, your mind defaults to the only possible explanation. You're not going to think, oh, an impossible thing happened.
Sure, sure.
So, but I take your point about the blocking. I do think that could have been executed a little bit more neatly.
Yeah. But anyway, so once James and Sydney leave, Cecilia is alone in the house just talking to Adrian. Mm-hmm. She spreads a bunch of coffee grounds on the floor to see him coming if he just takes a run at her. But that doesn't really seem to be his game at this point. Just asking him, what's the point? You've already taken everything. It's just,
yeah. Why me?
Well, that too. It's like two parts of the conversation. One is you've
not
already
much of
taken
a conversation.
Everything. Sure. It's two parts of the monologue. Why me? What makes me so special? I'm just a suburban girl who happened to wander into your life. You could have had anyone. But then also, there's nothing more for you to take. Let me go.
How wrong she is. She calls his cell phone and hears it vibrating in the attic, which is worrisome. So then she goes into the attic. And this is kind of, it's a funny moment. It reminded me of the scene in The Exorcist where Ellen Burstyn goes into the attic for several minutes and not much happens, but it's like the fucking scariest thing ever filmed just because it's dark.
Right.
And it's just funny that that trick would still work in a movie like this because the concept is such that it doesn't matter what the lighting conditions are.
Right.
You can't see the man. It doesn't matter. You could be in the white void from THX-1138 and he would be just as dangerous as in a pitch black room. Now, it's nice to be able to see your own hands in front of you, I guess, but I just think it's funny that, like, instinctual fear of the darkness still kicks in,
well, yeah,
even
exactly.
When your opponent is invisible.
Everybody's deep down just a little bit afraid of the dark. So, but yeah, she finds the phone. She finds on it pictures of her and Sydney asleep in Sydney's bed. They've been sharing it.
She finds her stolen schematics that she meant to bring to her job interview.
Her architectural drawings. And she gets a text comes through on Adrian's phone from an unknown number that just says surprise, and she wheels around and he's not up there, or if he is, he doesn't like pounce at this point like you might expect. And then she walks back over to the hatch,
I guess.
Yes.
Yeah,
she walks back over to the hatch, or sort of crawls on hands and knees over the hatch. And I expected the ladder to be gone for some reason.
Right,
this is the ladder
that she bought for James.
Right,
so.
I thought she might have to drop down and she'd hurt herself or something, but no, it's there. And she just sort of peers at it for a while, and then she decides to take a bucket of paint.
Yeah, she upends a bucket of white paint all over the ladder, revealing a humanoid figure crouching on it, big, loud scare cord. You don't see the paint bucket before this happens, which it would ordinarily be a little bit of a shortcut, but it didn't bother me just because the ladder and the idea that James have been painting are there's a link that's been forged there in the audience's mind.
Is there
a throwaway shot that I missed?
There's no like shots where it's like paint bucket, but you do you do see a couple of paint buckets in like some
okay.
of the wides of the attic.
Gotcha.
So it is there, but as you say, it is prepared for regardless, so it works.
So Cecilia makes it down out of the attic. There's a melee in the kitchen. She and Adrian properly fight for the first time. This is the first time that you get unmistakable invisible man wrestling, like Hollow Man style, where Elizabeth Moss is being picked up and hurled across the room, that kind of thing. She's smashing plates over his head. And then she books it out of the house into the night, calls an Uber. Uber's upstate, a good distance. I'm not sure how far exactly. All the way back to the house that she shared with Adrian. She's looking for proof that he has de-visibled himself, and she finds it in the basement and in his laboratory, which you got a glimpse of during the escape montage. Yeah,
she gets into the basement lab and finds this suit. It's basically just like a nightmarish, it's like a spider that's all eyes.
Yeah, it's really upsetting looking. It looks like it's just, yeah, covered. It's studded with compound eyes, the whole thing, head to toe. Just hundreds, well, dozens, if not hundreds, of robotic eyes, cameras, in effect, that are meant to refract light in such a way that you can't see the person in the suit.
Or even, honestly, I just assumed it worked like the fucking car in Die Another Day. You know, it just like the cameras on one side take in images that get projected out the other side,
that sort of thing. Very well might be.
That was just my assumption, but that's because Die Another Day at a formative age. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're actually entitled to some kind of compensation. I don't pretend to understand real science, much less made up movie science. So that explanation works for me. It is an intimidating looking suit, and I was actually surprised that it was a suit, because every version of this story that I've encountered previously, even the silly ones, even like say your League of Extraordinary Gentlemen kind of situation, it's always been a serum.
Yeah.
And it didn't even occur to me that it would be anything but a serum this time around. So then when the suit came into play, I thought, oh, why didn't I think of that? That's so much more credible than drinking a magic potion, basically.
I got the sense that it was a suit simply because
the silhouette in the paint looks weirdly
it looks like a golf ball.
It looks like a PS1 character model. It looks like a Silent Hill character in like the mid to late 90s, where their face is made of six polygons.
Right. But it's specifically, there's like this sort of pitted, again, right, golf ball like surface, and I figured, well, if it's just a serum, it would just look like a human face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah. And plus all the stuff about him being an optics guy as opposed to a mad scientist.
Right.
You know, a chemist of some kind. So yeah, she finds the suit and she socks it away in her go bag crevice. We get the sense it's not immediately revealed, but we're assuming that it's not the only suit, and sure enough, it is not. But she socks that away.
She goes to meet Emily at a restaurant. She calls her from the Uber and says that they need to meet in a public place right away. She has proof that she's not crazy.
Wait, there's another encounter with Adrian before she leaves the house, though, right?
Oh, yeah. It's a little blink and you miss it. But yes, he does get the drop on her one last time.
And I thought the dog was going to eat it, because the dog...
The dog
she got
might
the dog
eat it,
loose.
Because this time she takes my advice and does just head for the hills.
No, but the dog's at the end of the movie, too.
Is he? I missed that.
Yeah,
okay.
So the dog's fine. But yeah, I thought he was going to just like break the dog's fucking neck when the dog got in the way in this. But yeah, she gets away in the Uber. And she calls her sister on the way and like, let me know if you can meet me. Or if you can't, let me know that too, because I have to call somebody else if you can't. I don't know how much time I have. And her sister agrees to meet her at a restaurant. And she's sort of cautiously receptive, given how heinous this email apparently was.
Adrian wrote it, needless to say. So it must have been
pretty fucking heinous.
Right.
And Cecilia seems to be bringing her sister around, and her sister's listening and seems to be taking it all in. And then the knife. This is yet another fucking... This movie is riddled with Chekhov's items. A knife from James's kitchen that has gotten Cecilia's fingerprints on it. Although, it didn't really need to have them in advance. Anyway, there's this knife.
It was in the attic, right? In his, like, crawl space?
Yeah.
Hovel? Okay.
And anyway, it's like floating in the air next to Cecilia. Her sister sees it and kind of like, what? And it sure enough floats over and just slices her throat open.
Yeah, as with the daughter getting socked across the jaw, it happens so quickly. And then next thing you know,
the knife has been just slapped into Cecilia's hand, and she's just holding a knife up. And of course, everyone in the restaurant thinks that,
yeah,
she murdered her sister.
Case closed.
Yeah, I mean, open and shut. Jesus.
The guy a couple rows behind us going, oh shit, oh shit, oh, oh, really sealed the deal for me.
I was thinking that on the inside, but I kept it in.
So Cecilia is institutionalized, seems like. I mean, she's dragged kicking and screaming into a mental ward somewhere,
screaming about how he's in here and he did this.
You can't see him, but he, you know, he's out to get me. It's things that the orderlies have heard 100 times.
1,000.
Yeah.
Even. Yeah.
And she's sedated. And as she's dozing off, she hears Adrian say, surprise, which is, yeah, the first time we've heard his voice since we saw him in the flesh when,
right,
he was trying
since to. Since he was beating on the window.
Right.
Of the car. Yeah.
She is informed the following day. I don't know if new tests were administered or if these are the results of the last round of tests from when she fainted at the job interview.
It was the last round of tests. The nurse says this specifically. She's pregnant.
Yes. And one thing we elided is that part of Adrian's scheme to get her more inseparably linked to him, more under his thumb, was that he wanted to knock her up. And she was, unbeknownst to him, taking birth control so that that would not happen. But she knew that that ruse couldn't last forever, which is why she got the fuck out of Dodge when she did. So she's shocked.
Yeah. And we figure out how it happened.
Yes.
Because the next thing we have is Tom showing up and informing her, well, on account of the fact that you've been charged with all this heinous stuff, murder and whatnot, you're no longer eligible to receive the payments. And also because you may be ruled mentally incompetent. So you can fight it, but you probably don't have the money to do that. And you could also just sign this document and make it all go away. Or there's another option. Mm-hmm. I don't know why he's whispering. They're alone. But it's then that he heel turns back around.
Ah, yes. The double, triple, reverse face turn, as I believe it's called. Yeah, no. This is when it's revealed that the two brothers are, in fact, in cahoots.
Yeah, he says, Adrian knew that you were trying to take birth control. He knows everything. He's always watching. How could you believe otherwise?
Yeah. He swapped out the birth control with placebos or something like that.
Or fertility drugs.
Yeah,
for all
right.
We know. And if you just come back to him and have the baby and continue your life with him, we could make this all go away. I don't know how. I mean, I know the man's got a lot of money, but Cecilia, for all everyone knows, just murdered her sister in cold blood in a room full of people.
Yeah, slashed her throat open, surrounded by witnesses. So I don't know how she's going to beat that rap. Maybe, I mean, certainly, if Adrian faked his death, then he's going to have to live under an assumed identity somewhere. Maybe the same is true of her. Maybe he's offering to spring her from...
Yeah, I guess they just run off and live on an island somewhere or whatever. But yeah, so this is when Cecilia gets a pretty satisfying speech about how, you know, I always thought that you were...
Your
under
brother's
his
victim.
Thumb, just like I was, and I felt bad because you're the blood relative, you're tethered to him for life, but now I just figured out that you're the jellyfish version of him.
And then there's a long enough pause that you kind of think that's all she's going to say, and you're like, okay, I kind of get it. And then she does the mic drop, meaning he's spineless.
Yeah.
It's like a version of his brother with no spine, and it is very satisfying.
Yeah.
The remainder of the movie is fairly satisfying. This begins, that jellyfish line is sort of a turning point for her. From here on out, she starts clawing her way back up from rock bottom where Adrian has put her. She begins by sweeping the papers off of the desk between her and Tom, rejecting his offer. And as he's stooping down to gather up the papers, she pilfers a pen from his briefcase, kind of Hannibal Lecter style, and pockets it. And she also takes a bit of some kind of sticky tack that was holding down a sign on top of the table.
Yeah. She uses this to hide the pen in, like, the shower in her room, and she passes inspection, and then her guard or whatever, the orderly, leaves, and this is when she steps in the shower, turns on the water, and announces, you're not going to have this baby, you're not going to have me. She begins to apparently attempt to commit suicide. She's pulling the pen, which is, it's a fountain pen. It's not just a...
Looks sharp enough to...
It's pretty sharp.
Looks sharp enough to split the atom, gotta say. Looks gratuitously sharp for even for a fountain pen, but it gets the job done. She starts lacerating her arm.
And sure enough, Adrian springs into action to try and stop her, and we find out that this is exactly what she wanted because she just starts jabbing him with it.
Yep, she punctures a bunch of cameras on his shoulder and chest, which causes the whole suit to start glitching out. Which is a little convenient, but it was a welcome sight at this point in the movie. You want a little bit of validation, a little bit of vindication for her at this point.
Although it looks for a while like it's not going to happen, because these fucking guards keep showing up two at a time and getting killed in pairs. And then two more show up, and Cecilia's like, no, he's right over there. No, seriously. And she's not even, like, brandishing it. She's on the ground. She's not a threat.
Yeah, she's complying.
Yeah, it's like, no, he's right there. Seriously. And then they die. But finally...
It really felt like when you're playing, I don't know, like hitman or something, and a mission is going horribly awry, and two more guards, pairs of guards just keep showing up, and you're like, oh, fuck, and you just have to, you just end up with a big old stack of corpses where, you know, oh, this was going so well. How did I fuck this up so badly? But, I mean, you kind of feel, I mean, Adrian seems pretty cool under the collar this whole time. He's nonplussed about the whole situation, but his suit is still on the fritz. And given that there are most likely security cameras in this hallway, the jig is basically entirely up by now, I would think.
I didn't even think about security cameras, actually, during this whole thing. I just kept thinking, like, man, if he just keeps killing all of them, she's still got no case. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There's got to be cameras, and that has to ruin things.
After the 11th slain guard, you're forced to... The prosecuting attorney would have to make the case that she's some kind of John Wick figure.
Well, that also occurred to me, and that... I figured if nothing else, this would be what brought James around.
Uh-huh.
He'd have to be, like, talking to his colleagues, like... There's no way she did this. I mean, she's like 5'4", 120 pounds. She killed all of these cops with a pen. Fuck no. Like,
yeah. She just went like Joe Pesci in Casino on all of them. So she pursues Adrian out into the parking lot, torrential downpour, and she took this into consideration too. She saw a weather bulletin on the TV earlier when she was in the commons room or whatever it is when she was talking to Tom.
Yeah. So there's a car chase. Adrian, before he leaves, says, I'm going to take this out on the people you care about. He's going to go kill Sydney. And so she's chasing him in another car and calls James, tells him, get to the house. You have to protect Sydney. Adrian apparently gets into the house and
takes some pepper spray to the face.
Yeah.
When he goes to attack Sydney in her bed,
starts choking her out. James gets in there. He beats the hell out of James. And then Cecilia shows up just in time with the fire extinguisher,
mm-hmm.
flame retardant goop. And then once she can see Adrian, bam, 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 dead. And they pull off the camera mask on his head. And we find out it's not Adrian, it's Tom. Then the cops raid Adrian's mansion, find this boarded up space in the basement where Adrian has apparently been captured this whole time. And he basically sells the narrative that Tom was always the controlling one and Tom did all of this. And Cecilia doesn't buy it. James kind of buys it. He's receptive to her line of thinking. But in the end, he's like, listen, you just... Even if you don't believe this, you have to buy into it because this is how you get off. This is how you aren't blamed for your sister's murder. Just let it happen. Let me do my job. And Cecilia has a plan instead. She calls up Adrian and says, like, okay, I'm going to come meet you. And gets all dressed up, goes to the house, and they have this very tense dinner scene where she's trying to get him to admit what he did. And we assume she's wearing a wire. And sure enough, it cuts to a shot outside with James in his car with headphones on, listening in. And Adrian holds to the line like, I didn't do this. Tom did this. I was a victim too.
Yeah, but then he, not so sneakily, how does he shoehorn the word in? It's this can't possibly come as a surprise to you or something like
right,
that.
Like,
and he really relishes the word surprise to let her and her alone know that, yes, it was me the whole time.
So this is when she says, I'm going to go get myself cleaned up. And I figured she was going to like say something to James on the wire or something. But instead, it cuts back to Adrian alone at the dinner table.
Dead-eyed stare. He's completely dropped the charming, I'm trying to win you back routine now that she's out of the room. Looks like a total maniac.
Then we see the knife.
Or a knife.
Big old knife floating there. Gets his hand on it. And then he appears, crucially, for the security cameras watching, to open his own throat.
Yep.
And bleeds out. She runs out of the bathroom screaming, wailing, and calls 911 and kind of backs away. And once she's out of view of the cameras, she also drops the act.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, surprise. As you might expect, given the fact that she stashed a suit earlier, as she's walking out and James is running in, And this is when the dog is with her, by the way.
Yes, she walks out with
the dog. She's got the other suit in her bag.
And it really does just look like a purse full of eyes. It's a very distressing image. It looks like something out of like a fucking H.R. Giger painting. It's really, really awful.
Yeah. And James seems kind of alarmed that she could have done this. But I guess he kind of comes around and says, yeah, it sounded like he killed himself.
Yeah, in the same way that he was trying to cajole her into selling the lie of Adrian being blameless in this whole affair, she then kind of cajoles him into playing along with her charade instead.
Yeah. And then the movie ends on this very kind of ominous shot of her just kind of stone-faced, and there's this big swelling dramatic chord before it cuts to black. And like, I don't know if it's trying to imply that Cecilia's snapped or something.
She starts smiling towards the end, and it's not a maniacal, I've gone off the deep end, like the Killing Joke kind of smile. It's more like, I don't know, I mean, it's a good compromise between ominous and uplifting, I'd say. I mean, I think that it's grisly, but it is an empowering experience for her to have come out the other end of this having won. I think really what it's doing is indicating that, well, you know, this movie has been doing pretty well at the box office from what I understand. And so if Universal is taking a second pass, a humbler, saner pass at some kind of dark universe thing, it's possible that we'll get Cecilia back. I mean, she still has an invisibility suit. She might maybe use it to do other vigilante things. I don't know. I kind of hope that that's not how this plays out. But that's kind of what that last shot left me thinking about. Is that this might not be the last time that she devisibles herself and gets things done her own way. Looks like she's kind of got a taste for it in that last shot.
Well, I guess we can get more into it after the break. For now, we'll take that break and then we'll be back in a bit.
He was a sociopath. He said that I could never leave him. He controlled how I looked and what I wore. Then I was controlling when I left the house. And eventually, what I thought.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
He said that wherever I went, he would find me. Walk right up to me, and I wouldn't be able to see him. Adrian is dead. He's not dead. He has figured out a way to be invisible.
And we're back. I don't want to keep harping on that closing shot, really. Something about the chord they were using.
You mean musically?
Musically.
Speaking?
Just struck me as too ominous. And the expression she's got on her face is a little too Sphinx-like for me to just assume that there's nothing sinister about it when you throw in that chord.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think that if it is sequel bait, they're hedging their bets as to whether she's going to be hero, villain, or anti-hero. I mean, I think anti-hero is a pretty safe bet because that just means somewhere in the middle of that spectrum.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I don't think they've quite decided where they're going to go with her character or with whatever Universal monster reboot this movie might usher in a second wave of. Obviously, the Tom Cruise mummy was completely dead on arrival.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right insofar as it's not so indisputably ominous that they couldn't get away with, if they did a sequel, her not being a fucking murderous loon, but they could also definitely just do that.
Yeah. So,
which would, you know, be a letdown, but again, it wouldn't come entirely out of left field with the way this movie ends. So yeah, they did, I think, hedge their bets just about as well as they could have if they want to go in one of two kind of entirely divergent directions.
Gotta say, it would be hard to root for anybody wearing that suit. You know, yeah. That is, it is not the suit of someone dispensing vigilante justice in a wholesome, super heroic kind of way.
Yeah, this is not a dapper trench coat, sunglasses, and face scarf get up.
No.
This is nightmarish.
Well, it looks, even when it's in her bag, it looks semi-sentient because the cameras keep twitching and, like, readjusting their shutters, it looks like.
Okay, so, I think you just conjured that up in your head.
Well, okay, maybe not in the purse, but they definitely do it when it's still in the lab, like,
okay,
when it's on display.
True. But I think that's because it's, like, it's
calibrating.
It's connected to a tablet. That's how she makes it visible in the first place. So it's presumably, like, powered on and active and stuff. Right. I think
it still, to my eyes, looks like an even more arachnoid symbiote suit, like out of Spider-Man. It looks like a symbiote suit that's just replete with spider eyes, which is...
You're absolutely right about that. I'm just saying,
worst.
I don't think it's moving in the purse.
No, you're probably right about that. That would be a little too Spider-Man, a little too Venom.
We are Venom, like a turd in the wind.
Where's that crossover? Come on, guys, get with it. You know what it looks like, the suit, I mean, when it's in action, especially towards the end when it's on the fritz and more or less on full display? It looks like the entity that comes crawling out of the dubstep void in Annihilation. The doppelganger.
Yeah.
And in fact,
the dubstep void.
Yeah, the wub portal. In fact, I think part of the reason that part of the reason that Annihilation was on my mind was because this movie is full of wubs. Like that, the music is very droning and thrumming and kind of, you know, and I think that's part of what gives that last shot such an ominous vibe, is because never really strays away from that would-be Alex Garland kind of, I think Alex Garland would have made a pretty kick-ass version of this screenplay, actually, although Lee Wannell also did a very fine job for the most part.
Yeah. If you want to pick one word to describe Annihilation, ominous would be a pretty solid choice.
Sure. For sure.
But yeah, no, I agree. Lee Wannell did a pretty solid job with this overall, and this is coming from someone who has been typically fairly lukewarm at best on his work. I like Upgrade well enough. I don't think I liked it quite as much as you did, or quite as much as some other people I know did. It might have been because I think I saw it at an 11:45 p.m. showing when it was in theaters, and I was insufficiently energized to enjoy myself.
Sure.
But Upgrade was all right, and I think Wannell directed Insidious Part 3 or Chapter 3 or whatever the fuck it was called, and that was all right. But most of his collaborations, usually just on the screenwriting side and sometimes with supporting acting roles with James Wan in a lot of his films, have left me, if not entirely cold, certainly fairly cold.
Yeah, it's a collaboration that started with Saw, which we're not wild about.
No.
Here on the Shock Doctors podcast.
No,
it's okay, but it casts way too long a shadow for what it is.
There's a lot that's really dopey about Saw,
mm-hmm,
and that whole franchise, and that's where Lee Wannell comes from. And even some of their better collaborations, like The Conjuring, the first one's decent. And
well, did he do The Conjuring? Because weren't we just The Conjuring was the twin brothers, right?
Oh, that's
who did,
right.
Who did The Turning? So
that's
you can't pin that one on him.
I'm sorry, I just assumed he's involved with all of them.
Yeah, that's, I mean, right. They are until Upgrade. They really were more or less interchangeable in my mind. And I guess James Wan is doing Fast and the Furious and DC movies now, so he's upgraded, pun intended, as well. But
yeah. The Insidious movies are fair to middling for the most part.
Yeah, some are fair and some are middling.
and then at least one is awful.
Yeah, what's that? What's the fucking guy's name? He did Escape Room. Adam Robitel. Adam Robitel did the fourth one. He's not like Jeff Wadlow bad, but he's not much better.
Yeah, he's awful close. He's less... He's less auteur bad.
Yeah, he's bad in like a workman-like kind of unpretentious way.
So, in that sense, we have a little bit more respect for him. Point being, we're getting a little bit off track. Lee Whannell has been very hit or miss for me and for us, I think, generally. But once he's kind of struck out on his own, gotten a little bit of distance from James Wan, I think that has done him a world of good.
Yeah, I mean, I liked Upgrade a fair bit, but I do think it was a bit of a one-trick pony, and the trick was the way that the camera work collaborated with the fight choreography to make you feel like you were watching combat from a robot's perspective. Like the way that a machine would fight its way out of a situation. The camera moves with flawless computer-like precision in a way that is kind of thrilling and novel. And that's basically what elevates that movie above, you know, your run-of-the-mill kind of Black Mirror-y, post-Robocop-y kind of cyberpunk body horror, what have you. Now, Invisible Man doesn't have a singular gimmick. It does, I think, maybe to its detriment, fall back on that Upgrade style,
yeah,
Whannell vision occasionally.
I was gonna say,
and it's out of place here.
It does share some visual DNA with Upgrade, mostly in the mental hospital escape sequence.
Yeah, that's where you get
killing all the fucking cops,
right? And like he'll slam someone into a wall, and the camera will go with them, stop on a dime, then swing back the other way, then pivot 180 degrees and stare straight down at the floor. And it's got to be on some kind of rig that's been fed instructions to move just so at just the right time. And I'm not sure why, because I get that he's in a state-of-the-art sci-fi supersuit, but they're still scrapping with a human being. It should be sloppier. It should feel sloppier than it is.
Not to mention, you never get the sense that the invisibility suit is like a combat augmentation suit. It's just...
Yeah, it's not like military grade.
Yeah, it's just presumably like a bodysuit with a bunch of cameras slapped on it. And that's the extent of it. And whatever wiring and tech is required to make those cameras do what they're supposed to do. But it's not supposed to be enhancing his movements at all. So he would theoretically move like a human. And, you know, maybe because he's such a fucking sociopath, maybe he moves like a robot all the time. Maybe that's the idea.
Yeah, but I mean, Cecilia's always talking about how controlling he was and how every facet of his life was kind of arranged just so. So that is a logical extension of his psychology, I guess. But I don't know. In general, and I thought this even before the Whannell vision kicked into high gear, when she's tussling with him in the kitchen, cracking plates over his head, I wanted more sloppiness was the word I just used, just more physicality from him. I wanted to hear panting. I wanted him to get out of breath. You know, it looked at times too much like this was more like a remake of The Entity, where she was fighting something superhuman and otherworldly rather than just, well, bear in mind too, at the time, this is before the reveal of the suit. So at the time, I thought that she was just throwing down with a naked dude. Where you know, so the knowledge that he's in a suit does mitigate this problem a little, but I still want to hear, I want to get the sense that his heart's racing and that he's short of breath a little bit, just to make you feel like your opponent is flesh and blood, even if you can't see them. This is one thing, maybe the only thing that I liked better about Hollow Man, is that in Hollow Man, because Paul Verhoeven's a pervert, you do always get the sense that you're just going toe-to-toe with an insane naked man. And you hear Kevin Bacon going like, oh, God, you fucking bitch, you know, and like all of that good stuff. And I'm glad that this movie doesn't have all of those very early 2000s, very impressed with what was then cutting-edge CG Hollow Man theatrics, where here's invisible Kevin Bacon surrounded by steam, and here he is in a pool, and here he is in a downpour, and there he is on fire, and all of that stuff. 9 times out of 10 in this movie, you get a little bit of flame retardant foam here, a little bit of rain there, but for the most part, for the most part, you just can't see him. And that's way more effective, as it turns out. And I think that audiences, thankfully, have matured to the point where they don't expect to be dazzled by special effects in every single scene. It's enough to just see Elizabeth Moss get lifted off her feet.
Right. Well, and at the end of the day, the thing that makes this movie work during its more tense, horror-y sequences, because not to beat this dead horse into the ground, but we always have at least a few of these every couple of months. This is less of a horror movie and more of a thriller, I think.
Sure.
But those sequences in the dark, in the house earlier on, like in James and Sydney's house where Cecilia's staying, where we don't see anything and we don't know exactly what we're looking for. What you can't see is always scarier than what you can see, or at least almost always.
Yeah, and the fact that it doesn't resort to all of these Hollow Man theatrics, you never see a bunch of footprints treading through the coffee grounds, for example. You
right.
don't see, sometimes you see an impression of something that could be a footprint or someone sitting in a chair, but it's never 100% clear. You never get those, like, Frodo with the ring on. Kind of like, whoa, I'm invisible shots.
You know what I just thought of, which
what?
Is what made me laugh 20 seconds ago? Fucking Paranormal Activity. The fucking demon feet after they throw down the flower or whatever.
Yeah, none of that,
the
mercifully.
The demon footprints. Yeah, no, there is none of that, which is good. But it's funny you mentioned the maybe he's sitting in a chair. You can't really tell. The cushion looks a little bit squashed. There's a shot where Cecilia's looking at the chair in her and Sydney's bedroom in the dark, and it looks like it's squashed in. And for whatever reason, that was the part that got to me the most.
Mm-hmm.
Something about an invisible man just sitting in a chair.
Yeah, just chillaxing.
Looking at you, and you see this like little bit of a depression in the cushion. That just skeeved me out.
Well, the trailer or teaser for this that I remember seeing the most often is built around a moment that's not in the movie,
yeah.
where she says there's someone sitting in that chair and James or somebody does not believe her.
I was thinking about that as I was describing the scene I did
describe. So they know that it's an effective image, a chair with a slight depression in it, but they either filmed that exchange just for the marketing or couldn't fit it into the movie. But in any case, they knew what they had on their hands. They knew that that was going to resonate with people as it resonated with you.
They probably decided they couldn't do the same gag twice.
Yeah.
That's probably what it came down to. They probably had both of those scenes in the first cut of the movie. And then they're like, well, this one's more low-key and in the dark and creepy. So even though this is good for promotional purposes, we probably don't keep it in.
Yeah, it is a pretty lean movie for the most part. The middle stretch does have a little bit too much of Elizabeth Moss going room to room in a seemingly empty house, looking around fearfully for my liking. That gets a little bit samey, but that stint really doesn't last very long. And it helps that Elizabeth Moss has the best fearful eyes in the business. You know, she like no one is better at fidgeting and looking strung out, especially as you get deeper into the movie. She just gives a very committed, very believable performance. And when she's institutionalized, she looks genuinely unwashed. She looks
so
bedraggled. There's like, yeah, there's yeah, the hair looks like it could use some shampoo, and there's like grease on the forehead that looks like she hasn't had a shower in a couple days, and it's unusual to see that in a movie like this. It's really setting aside of the celebrity ego. That's nice to see. They're looking really unphotogenic at times, which I liked. And it also jives with something that it resonates thematically too, because she says about Adrian that he controlled everything about her, what she ate, how she dressed, what she looked like, eventually what she said, and even what she thought. So this idea that the deeper she gets into the movie, the more stripped down her appearance gets, the less makeup she wears, that has a pseudo-feminist element too, and that point is driven home even more so because then when she shows up at his house for the climax, she's made up again just the way he liked it, presumably. And the fact that we've just seen her looking so bedraggled makes her made-up face with the lipstick and whatever else all the more impactful. Even when she, the last ruse of her going into the bathroom saying, I should clean myself up, I think there's a reason that she makes that excuse. She doesn't say, I have to go to the bathroom. She
right.
says, I should go get myself cleaned up implicitly for you so that
right.
I'm pretty for you.
Keeps him off guard.
Yeah, and that's why he lets her walk out of the room unsupervised, because she's going to go make herself pretty for him, and then she slits his throat. good riddance. But that, yeah. But I just think that everything to do with her being made up or not made up in this movie is very canny. But also, just, you know, it makes her look more like a person who's been in a padded room for a day or two. It just sells that idea that she is being held against her will, which is always crucial when you have a story development like that.
While you were talking about the physicality of the tussling with the Invisible Man and talking about Kevin Bacon and Hollow Man grunting, you know, fucking bitch and all this stuff, suddenly I know where you got it from that you wanted it in Black Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Well, and Black Christmas, yeah, I wanted more grunting, more panting. I wanted them to not be boring automatons who were in a trance, as one of that movie's biggest problems for me. I also, as I was going on that rant, thought about the Child's Play remake and how badly I missed Brad Dourif. Because he would also do the, ah, you fucking bitch routine. And it's so much more charismatic than the Pinocchio thing where Mark Hamill just wants to be a real boy. He just wants to be the kid's best friend.
Yeah.
It's that remake is going to have no shelf life whatsoever.
Nah, I already barely remember it.
Right. I only remembered it in the context of ranting about another remake with a similar problem. I like this new Invisible Man a whole lot more than last year's Child's Play. That should be readily apparent.
Or Black Christmas.
Or Black Christmas, yes. I said that this movie was sort of a Me Too thing. I mean, I think that's pretty unmistakable. I alluded to this before the break. I hope that didn't sound flippant. You know, I mean, I do think you said that this isn't a horror movie. I know what you're saying. I'm inclined to agree with you. It does play out, especially by the end where you get a fucking car chase. Horror movies and car chases just do not mix.
No.
Like, by then, you're in full-blown thriller territory. That being said, this is a horror movie insofar as the relationship that she's trapped in when the movie begins is horrifying. And you feel her trepidation and her terror when she's tiptoeing around, gathering up all her things and preparing to flee for her life.
Sure.
Even the talk about how he wanted her to have a baby and she didn't want to have a baby, so she started taking birth control. That sex could not have been consensual.
No.
And it's just, it's such a nightmare. And there's a whole, I think if this movie was a little less genre, a little bit less lightweight, low stakes thriller, it might have lingered on that relationship a little more. I do think it gains from Adrian being something of an enigma, you know, that we only hear him going, Cecilia, Cecilia, and then that's it, effectively, for the vast majority of the movie. That we only kind of get acquainted with him right at the very end. That does work for me. I do like the way that the movie trains you to be afraid of him even before he's invisible, and to worry that somehow his influence is encroaching on Cecilia's life even before he fakes his own death, you know, with her spray painting over the webcam and being afraid to go outside and all of that agoraphobic copycat stuff. It's really, you can just feel the toxicity, and I think that that's kind of what, you know, Mummy tanked, right? Mummy, yeah, it had to, otherwise we would have gotten two or three sequels by now. Yeah, Mummy made no money. Mummy made no money whatsoever. The Tom Cruise one. And I think that part of the reason that Invisible Man is making money and will maybe not revitalize this Universal horror classic monsters property is that it's a movie that could have only come out in the last few years, whereas the Tom Cruise Mummy is just a Tom Cruise movie that could have come out at any point after the first Brendan Fraser Mummy movie, let's say. Right. It's impossible to pin it down. I mean, I guess it's such a naked attempt to launch a cinematic universe that it would have to be post-Avengers. But
right.
Other than that, there's no way to pin it in history. It's just this kind of shapeless blob of a thing, whereas the new Invisible Man is very much of its time, I think. And I don't know, maybe the average moviegoer is cognizant of that. Maybe they aren't. But it's part of what sets this movie apart for me, at least. And I don't know. I kind of wish this movie had been called Hollow Man, actually. There's something about Adrian's dead-eyed stare at the table right before his throat gets slit that really...
I mean, he is hollow.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That he's just a vacuous person. He's a black hole of a man. And so I would have... But, you know, the Invisible Man works too, in that he is evil basically right out in the open, and he gets away with it routinely because of his privilege, his wealth and status and his charisma and so on and so forth. So I guess Invisible Man works as a double entendre too. Okay, I've said my piece.
Yeah, I think what I said about, I've been trying for the last couple of minutes to remember which movie it was I said this about, and I believe it was Us. I said during that episode of the podcast that, with the exception of the opening sequence of Us, which is just like a perfect horror short unto itself.
Right.
But for the most part, the rest of the movie is less of a horror movie, except on the sociological level.
Yeah, that's an apt comparison, I think.
On the sociological level, Us is fucking horrifying.
And whenever Elizabeth Moss starts making creepy faces.
Which is Elizabeth Moss again.
Yeah, a little bit more connective tissue for you there.
Yeah, so absolutely right. So in the same way, yes, Invisible Man, as you say, when you think about the relationship that Cecilia suffered through and the psychological damage that she sustains and endures, and how that's reflective of thousands and thousands of similar or identical relationships and situations out in the real world, in that sense, this is definitely still a horror movie. But in the surface level nuts and bolts, this is...
There's a car chase.
How the movie works. There's a car chase. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a horror movie in certain stretches early on with the Conjuring-y type stuff, the James Wan blanket stuff,
yeah.
In the bedroom and so forth. And it works on that level. But beyond that, it's only a horror movie in the deeper, broader sense.
Yeah, the horror kind of lurks around the fringes, which is occasionally where it's most effective. But Lupita Nyong'o's raspy voice and bulging eyes also freaked me out. I would be remiss if I didn't point that.
Sure.
Anyway, we're not giving Us another day in court. Us was a very good movie.
And we said so at the time, yes. So we don't need to give it another day
in court.
We're
not recanting anything.
Yeah, it's similar in that sense, this movie and that movie. Well, on that note, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisi.
And because I apparently didn't say it at the top of the show, we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Invisible Man Official Trailer HD, uploaded by Universal Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, March 29th, and our apologies for the mix-up. This time, we'll actually be discussing Brahms The Boy 2. See you then.